I wanted to thank you all for really hanging with some more complex messages lately. And I know I've been digging deep. Last week, tried to get into that third rail of contemporary Christianity and talk about heaven and hell in a way that you might not have heard before. Sometimes y'all are a little hard to read. I always can tell that you're listening. I don't know what you're thinking half the time. So hopefully that was a good message, a thought-provoking message last week. I kind of want to follow on from where we left off and dig a little deeper here, because there's so much about what we believe that affects the way we live. We talked last week about the fact that the reality that you believe is the reality that you endure. And that's just the way it is. You know, nobody really experiences reality as it is. We experience reality through the filter of what we believe. What we think about reality is what is admitted through that filter. And so these belief systems are really important. We talked last time about our beliefs about hell, especially, because our beliefs about hell are going to alter the way we feel about God. If hell ultimately is a place of everlasting torment and God puts us there and throws away the key, it becomes difficult for us psychologically as people to trust that that God really has our back, to trust that we are really okay, that right here, right now, everything is fine, and the good news gets compromised. Jesus spent so much time trying to give a message of good news that was a message about who his Father was, that the Father was always drawing, never giving up. Story after story, like the prodigal son, is testimony to what Jesus was trying to get across to us, that there is never a time when his Father stops drawing, stops giving up. A message like that has a profound effect on how we approach our lives, because when we can move from fear of punishment to a love relationship, everything starts to change. It's the fear that drives us into obsessive compulsive directions. It's the fear that makes us crazy and do crazy things and break relationships and hoard and hold on to things that we think we need and may not get in the future. But once we understand who God is and who we are in God, things can begin to change. But it's difficult. We talked about the fact that there is no word in the Bible analogous to hell as we understand it. There are five words that are used, but they're different. And some of this might have been jarring for some of you. I don't know. What I want to stress to you is that what we were talking about last week was not that there is no hell, but that God does not put us there and throw away the key. If we're there, like the Jews believed, it's a state of being. In Jewish afterlife, everybody goes to the same place, and it depends on whether you're connected to God, then you're in heaven. If you're not and separated, then you're in hell. And so it's a different way of looking at the same thing. Ultimately, it's not so much me trying to change your beliefs. What I'm trying to do up here is to get you to question your beliefs. Like that 17-year-old who asked his father, you know, is what you believe really true, or is it just what you believe? We all need to be asking that question. And even more to the point, besides what our beliefs, whether they're true or not, is what effect do our beliefs have on the way that we live our lives? This is huge. And the thing is that we don't really fully comprehend how much our belief system affects the way that we live, the choices we make, the attitudes we have. Our belief system, you know, at its very largest extent, is called a worldview. It's the way that we look at the world. It's the way that we understand reality. That worldview has everything to do with how we behave and the choices we make. If we believe it's a worldview that people are basically bad, that they're predators, that they will get you at every turn, then you're going to live your life very differently, defensively, like a soldier on a battlefield, than if you believe that people are basically good and have your interest at heart. Very different things. And so examining what we believe and looking at the natural consequences of what we believe is so important. An unexplored life, a life that has left some of these things undiscovered, unexplored, you know, unresolved, is going to constantly be at odds with itself. You know, there's going to be that undercurrent of dissonance, of distrust, of not really knowing. Jesus is trying to clarify issues for us, and it's important for us to go there. I wanted to try to illustrate that a bit so they can really get this under our fingers, how important it is for us to understand the consequences of our beliefs, if not so much the beliefs themselves. For instance, I just got an email just last week from a friend who lives in England, and he's got an interesting past. He was born in Sri Lanka. If you don't know where Sri Lanka is, it used to be called Ceylon. It's a little island teardrop that hangs off the end, the bottom of India. He was born there. He lived his first few years there in a predominantly Buddhist country, yet he was raised as a Catholic, then emigrated to England and finished growing up there, and then now has switched to Judaism, and now a Jew who follows Jesus. It's just been an amazing journey for him. But he was examining the same area of what you believe affecting how you act, the decisions you make and the attitudes you have. And he was talking about it in the context of reincarnation, because there's lots of people around him in England that believe in reincarnation. And just listen to a little bit of what he writes. There are those in the Western world who are really taken with reincarnation. To them, it's something novel and exciting. But they have not seen the results of reincarnation on a society that embraces it. I was born in Sri Lanka, a predominantly Buddhist country that believes in the concept of reincarnation, which tends to give you a disturbingly blasé attitude toward death. In Sri Lanka and India as well, drivers can be really reckless on the road. They don't fear death because they believe that if they die in an accident, they will just be reincarnated. In the 1990s, when the nuclear arms race was heating up between India and Pakistan, people in India were asked, "Don't you fear annihilation from nuclear weapons? Doesn't it frighten you knowing that there is a real danger, that India might be obliterated off the face of the earth?" A common reply was, "No, we'll all be reincarnated." I had a friend back in the 90s who had embraced reincarnation. He had a distinctive attitude to his moral mistakes. "Oh well, if I make a mistake in this life, I can always correct them in the next one." He would not accept that what he did in this life was important and that he had to correct his mistakes in this life. A lack of sympathy for the suffering of others is not uncommon with those who adamantly believe in reincarnation. I personally come across remarks such as the comment from someone who had been told that his best friend's mother was dying of cancer. "Why are you upset? It's her own fault. She must have done something really bad in a previous life." Or to someone being badly bullied, "Why are you complaining? It's your own fault. So you just have to put up with it." Recently, I was talking to a friend whose partner is a staunch believer in reincarnation. He was telling me how she had been listing all her woes and ailments. So he told her about a man he once saw in Bangkok who had one whole side of his body burned and disfigured in a fire. He related to me how he had told her, "When I see that man, I realize that my problems are only small ones." His partner's reply was, "Why should I have any sympathy for a person like him? He obviously sinned in a past life, so he's being punished for it." Even if you manage to hold back unsympathetic remarks for those who are suffering or manage to take better care when doing dangerous things, there is still the openly expressed thought, when one undergoes any kind of pain, suffering, or misfortune, that this is my fault, so I shouldn't complain or do anything about it. Poor people end up accepting the misery of their poverty because they believe they are being punished for something that they have done. The downtrodden accept their oppression because they feel they are being punished for their sins in a past life. Now, this isn't necessarily indicative of everyone who believes in reincarnation, but there's a strain of this, and it logically proceeds. You know, if life is an endless series of reincarnations, it's going to do something to what you believe. What it's going to do, at the very least, it's going to devalue the importance of this life, right here and right now, if there have been endless past lives and endless next lives. And it changes your focus. The focus would be on the past lives and on the future lives, as opposed to this life. And it is difficult to have the same kind of sympathy, the same kind of caring, the same desire turned into motivation, even for social justice, even for fixing the circumstances that are currently around us. Because it's all going to be worked out in a future life. Things are the way they are because of past lives. And it changes the way that you look at the world. We need to understand how these beliefs affect us. So, reincarnation. Well, how about Christians? What's the focus in traditional Christianity? See, in traditional Christianity, the focus is on the afterlife. The focus is on heaven and hell. The focus is everything that we need to do here in order to get to that life. How many times have we heard that this life is but a vapor? This life is just something that we need to suffer through, to get through, because our reward is coming in the next life, not this life. You know? Remember the old spiritual song, "I'll Fly Away"? You know, the idea is that the soul is incarcerated in this body for a time, but it longs to flee and go back to where it came from, because the next life, the spiritual life, is the important one, and this one becomes devalued. There's a strain of Christianity called Calvinism, and some of you that have studied it know that the 5 points of traditional Calvin are summarized in the acronym TULIP, T-U-L-I-P. And if you really look at what Calvinism believes, it has huge ramifications on the way that you think and feel. The T stands for total depravity, which means everybody is born in original sin, completely lost, completely depraved, completely unable to come back to God in any way. The U stands for unconditional election, which means that God decides who is saved and who is not. Unconditionally, He elects those that will be saved, and He elects those who will not be saved. The L is limited atonement. That means that Jesus' death on the cross and the atonement that He effected there is only good for those who are already unconditionally elected, and not for those who weren't. No. The I is irresistible grace, which means that those who are elected to be saved will irresistibly be drawn by God's grace into salvation, and the others not. And the P, I got that right? I, P. P is perseverance of the saints. Once saved, always saved. Can't change your destiny. It's all about God's sovereignty and about predestination. Man has nothing to do with the whole affair. Just kind of along for the ride. What are going to be the ramifications, the consequences of that belief system? Do you think that you're going to be an evangelist? Why evangelize? God already has chosen who's saved and who's not. Are you going to be active in social justice, active in the things of this life? You're going to take more of a passive understanding. Now, classic Calvinism is so severe that most people don't practice it today. There's blended thought processes and theologies going on out there. But in general, Christianity, focused on the next life as it is going to be focused on the criteria for getting to heaven and avoiding hell, which means that the focus is going to be on a legal understanding. What do we need to do in order to be saved? Rather than a relational understanding. And it changes the way that we operate. If all the focus is on the next life, do you know that there have been many missionaries that I know of that set up programs, food programs, but you can't get the food until you've sat and heard the Bible and sat and heard the study and said the sinner's prayer. Then you can get the food. Because all the focus is on the salvation of the soul for the next life. This life is secondary. It changes things. It changes the way that we operate. Now in Judaism, the focus is on this life. This life alone. Doesn't mean that they don't believe there's a next life. They do. But that's God's domain, and God will take care of it. The idea is we are here living between heaven and earth. Our job is to live this life to the full, to dig into this life. Do our job by bringing the unity of heaven to earth and the individuality of earth into heaven. Merge the two. That's our job. If we do that job, then God is faithful and just, and everything will work out in the next life. We don't have to worry about it. It's God's area. We can let it go. What's the effect of that kind of understanding? Well, to this day, Jews are among the most socially conscious group on earth. They are constantly trying to fix the circumstances for themselves, for their families. I saw a statistic of how just in the tiny nation of Israel, there are more Nobel laureates by a factor of 10 or 50 than most other countries on the face of the earth. Because they are focused on making this world better. They're focused on making the lives of the entire tribe better. The entire globe. It changes the way that you look at things. Examining our beliefs, seeing what it is that they are bringing to us, is really, really important for us to do. Which of these beliefs do you think yields an effect most like God's love? Most like God's how? most like God's will. We talked about this. What is God's will? You know, we are so focused on the outcomes, on the events, on the what's of life, that we miss the fact that what God is really interested is in the how, in a process. Everything that he's telling us is how to love, how to relate. It's not about a set of criteria, a creed, or a belief system. That's a what. He's talking about a way, a process that takes us to a how. And so which belief system is going to match God's how the best? And what does God's how look like anyway? We say love. God is love. God's how looks like love. God's process, God's way of living life, God's will looks like love. But what does that mean? What does it mean? We've got here sitting this afternoon a brand newly married couple, Mike and Michelle over there. And give them a hand. So good to have you guys back. So I had the absolute honor to be able to officiate their wedding 3 weeks ago, and 3 weekends ago. And here they are. They're starting their lives together. And what does love look like for them? Brand new newlyweds, you know, with all the heady emotions and everything that they're going through. Yesterday, Marion and I had the honor to be able to renew the vows of Hector and Angelina Reyes. Many of you know them. They come here for their 50th wedding anniversary. 50 years. Amazing. Do you think there's a difference in the way Mike and Michelle experience their love as a married couple now and the way Hector and Angelina are experiencing their love as a married couple after 50 years? Is there a difference? Should there be a difference? You know, one of the things that I pointed out at Mike and Michelle's wedding was that the way we look at love is going to have huge consequences and huge ramifications for the way we experience love. We here in the West are all enamored with romantic love, with the emotions of love. It's all about love at first sight, you know? There's that romantic Jerry Maguire thing, you complete me. And as I pointed out to Mike and Michelle, you know, you complete me. We have a word for that in our culture, and it's codependence. If you're waiting for someone to complete you, you're going to be waiting a really long time. It's only when two complete people choose to share their togetherness that a marriage is made. But here's the idea in the West. We have so emphasized romantic love, we believe that love precedes marriage. We believe that love as we feel it, love as we understand it from our movies and from our media, is the prerequisite to a successful marriage. As if we just can love enough, hard enough, the right way, at the very beginning of a marriage, like a really strong push on a bicycle, it can roll all the way through 30, 40, 50 years of marriage. And if that doesn't sound inherently wrong to you, then let me just tell you, life has too much friction. You're going to have to start pedaling at some point. And so here's Hector and Angelina. After 50 years of marriage, the reason that they were standing in front of me yesterday and reciting their vows is because they learned how to pedal. They learned what it meant to work on love. And see, this is the Eastern view. The Jews of Jesus' time had arranged marriages. Most often, bride and groom didn't even meet each other until the day of their betrothal, which was the same as a marriage in that culture. They were arranged. And that sounds brutal to us. It sounds inhuman to us. It sounds abusive to us that we would force people into marriage when there wasn't any love before. But see, the Easterners look at love in a different way. They don't believe that love precedes marriage. They believe that marriage is the place where you learn how to love. It is the togetherness of marriage. It is hanging your toothbrushes side by side, year after year, facing what you face, learning what you learn about each other in that context that teaches you how to love. One Easterner put it this way. He said, "You Westerners put hot soup in a cold plate and it becomes slowly cold. We put cold soup in a pan on the fire and it becomes slowly hot." The way you look at love is going to have very, very strong consequences on how you experience it and how you experience your marriages. You got to pedal the bike. But this still doesn't tell us what love is. Okay, maybe we've determined that love is not a feeling. Is it a decision then? Is that what Hector and Angelina have done? Have they decided to stay together for 50 years? You know, is consistent action, is that what love is? What does Paul have to say at 1 Corinthians 13? Love is patient, love is kind, and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. So Paul is saying this is love. Just before it, at 1 John 4, we read that God is love. We have come to know and have believed that the love which God has for us. Start again. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love. And the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this love is perfected with us, so that we may have confidence in the day of judgment. Because so as he is, also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment, and the one who fears is not perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. If we're still fearing punishment, if we're still worried about the legal aspects, then we're not perfected in love. God is love. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is all these things that Paul is saying. But what Paul is pointing out here are attributes to love, actually effects to the cause of love. We're still trying to chase down what love is. It's important for us to understand this. What does love look like? Jesus says at Matthew 22:39, love your neighbor as yourself. And he's echoing Leviticus 19:18 there. Okay, that's taking us back to the how. Love your neighbor as yourself. The how, as yourself. Where is that going to take us? What's understood there? What does it look like if you're loving your neighbor as yourself? I want to read you a few stories. And these are coming from some of my favorite people in history, the Desert Fathers and Mothers of the 3rd and 4th century. They spent their time in either hermitages or cloistered communities in the deserts, inaccessible wilderness areas around Egypt and Palestine. They fled the city. They fled all the noise and distraction of their villages in order to try to find out who they were, to try to find and answer these questions that we're talking about. What is love? What is the basis of what we're trying to do here? And some of these stories are amazing. Here's one of Abba Amonas, a disciple of Anthony. It is said that in his solitude, he advanced to the point where his goodness was so great that he took no notice of wickedness. Hang on to that phrase. His goodness was so great that he took no notice of wickedness. Thus, having become bishop, someone brought a young girl who was pregnant to him, saying, "See what the unhappy wretch has done. Give her a penance." She became pregnant out of wedlock. But he, having marked the young girl's womb with the sign of the cross, commanded that 6 pairs of fine linen sheets should be given to her, saying, "It is for fear that when she comes to give birth, she may die, she or the child, and have nothing for the burial." But her accusers resumed, "Why did you do that? Give her a punishment." But he said to them, "Look, brothers, she is near to death. What am I to do?" Then he sent her away, and no old man dared accuse anyone anymore. Sound a lot like Jesus and the woman brought to him in adultery? Where are your accusers? Neither do I accuse you. Neither do I condemn you. Talk about a concept that can have an effect on our lives. What do you think about this taking no notice of wickedness? Does that even sound right to you? Does that sound just? Does that sound like what we should be doing? Because I'll tell you what, we're taking each other's inventories all the time, aren't we? We're always taking notice of wickedness, not only of other people, but of ourselves. Sometimes we're harder than ourselves than we are of anybody else. But the point is, we're always looking. We're always judging. Why do we do that? Because we're thinking legally. because we're thinking about heaven and hell, because we're thinking about how do we get in and how do we stay out and what are they doing and what do I need to do to help them to make sure that they are saved. Those beliefs have consequences. Amonas is going a very different direction, finding a very different result in his life. He advances to the point that he takes no notice of wickedness. There's a story of a hermit who was attacked by robbers in the desert. After being rescued by his fellow hermits, they rounded up the robbers and took them to the authorities in the nearest town to be thrown in jail. But after speaking with their abbot, the monks were so remorseful, they broke into the jail that night and released the prisoners from the torturers, taking no notice of wickedness, operating by the different set of rules that sound crazy to us, sound unjust to us. How about this one? One of the monks of Seat committed a grave error, and the wise hermit, the wisest hermit, was called upon to judge him. The hermit refused, but they insisted so much that in the end he agreed to go. He arrived carrying on his back a bucket with holes in it out of which poured sand. "I have come to judge my neighbor," said the hermit to the head of the convent. "My sins are pouring out behind me like the sand running from this bucket. But since I don't look back and pay no attention to my own sins, I was called upon to judge my neighbor." The monks called a halt to the punishment immediately. When so deeply involved in God's presence to the point it displaces our notion of wickedness, how exactly is a person ever offended or insulted, let alone outraged? Abbot Anthony, the founder of the monastic movement and father of all hermits, taught Abbot Amonas, saying, "You must advance yet further in the fear of God." And taking him out of his cell, he showed him a stone, saying, "Go and insult that stone, and beat it without ceasing." When this had been done, St. Anthony asked him if the stone had answered back. "No," said Amonas. Then Abbot Anthony said, "You too must reach the point where you no longer take offense at anything." There's another story where a young monk is told to go out into the graveyard and insult the dead. And when he comes back, he says, "Did they answer you?" He says, "No." "Now I want you to go out and praise the dead." "Did they answer you?" "No," he says. When you can react as the dead do to the insults and the praises of men, then you can advance in knowing who you are and who your Lord is, taking no notice of wickedness. It is said that Anthony himself came to the conclusion that the devil was not purely evil, since God could not create evil. And all his works are good. So to Anthony, even the devil himself still had some good in him. For these desert people, when identification with unity was full enough, it was almost impossible to regress or even recall the separation and division that used to define their lives. There were two elders living together in a cell, and they had never had so much as one quarrel with one another. One therefore said to the other, "Come on, let us have at least one quarrel like other men." The other said, "I don't know how to start a quarrel." The first said, "I will take this brick and place it here between us. Then I will say, 'It is mine.' After that, you will say, 'It is mine.' This is what leads to a dispute and to a fight." So they placed the brick between them, and one said, "It's mine." And the other replied to the first, "I do believe that it is mine." And the first one said again, "It's not yours, it's mine." So the other answered, "Well, then if it's yours, take it." Thus they did not manage after all to get into a quarrel. You know, there are also stories of monks who are rescuing people, like in the case of the one where they rescued him from being robbed, of stopping abuse, stopping aggression, and feeding people and taking care of them. And so we need to understand this idea of taking no notice of wickedness is really about the interior attitude that we have toward the circumstances and the actions we see around us, and not the physical response to those things. Yes, aggression needs to be stopped. Yes, victims need to be saved. But how do we feel about what it is that we're doing and the people who are the perpetrators in our lives? Are we angry? Are we trying to fix them in a codependent sort of way? What's going on? Or are we able to do what we need to do in the moment and then move back into that place of centeredness and that place of connection? It's all about identification. It's about who we see ourselves as and connected to that really makes the difference. And I think here we are really honing into what love is. A feeling, an action, a decision, an attribute? Who are we really? The desert fathers and mothers found out, the ones that weren't driven mad by the solitude and the loneliness, and it changed them. They learned that their identity, who they were at root, even the question itself, was meaningless except in the presence of God, in the context of relationship. Relationship with God and each other was the only relevance, significance, or meaning that there was to find anywhere. And to ask such questions outside that presence was not only pointless, but literally maddening. As these desert people became more attuned to the sole source of significance and meaning, they became more identified with it. And as they became more identified with it, whatever they had brought with them into the desert began sinking into the sands until all that was left of them looked like God, like love, thought like God, love, acted like God and love, and took no notice of wickedness. There is an amazing freedom and contentment in taking no notice of wickedness. To be so identified with God and each other that even the interior and exterior space between brothers and sisters breaks down, that every person encountered is not seen as an object to which either good or bad things can be done, but simply as an extension of self. This is exactly what loving your neighbor as yourself really means. Love is not anything that can be done or accomplished at all, but is simply the identification itself, the unity and connection with the beloved. Thomas Merton writes in Wisdom of the Desert, "Love, in fact, is the spiritual life, and without it, all other exercises of the spirit, however lofty, are emptied of content and become mere illusions. The more lofty they are, the more dangerous the illusion. Love takes one's neighbor as one's other self." Get that? Love takes one's neighbor as one's other self and loves him with all the immense humility and discretion and reserve and reverence without which no one can presume to enter into the sanctuary of another's subjectivity. Love demands a complete inner transformation, for without this we cannot possibly come to identify ourselves with our brother. We have to become, in some sense, the person we love, and this involves a kind of death of our own being, of our own self. No matter how hard we try, we resist this death. We fight back with anger, with recriminations, with demands, with ultimatums. We seek any convenient excuse to break off and give up the difficult task. So love is not a feeling, but it creates feelings and creates emotions. Love is not a decision. It's not an act, but it creates decisions. It creates actions. Love is not attributes, patient or kind, though those attributes are always present in the presence of love. Love is actually the identification with the beloved, becoming one and the same, blurring the distinction between us and the other. When we are loving as self, then we become the beloved. The golden rule that Jesus is talking about is this identification and how it plays out in our lives. Love is unity. God is love because God is unity. That's what we have to start to understand. What we believe about love is going to change the way we live our love lives. And I'm not just talking romantically here. I'm talking with every relationship that we have. When love becomes unity, when love becomes identification, when we are living for that unity, everything else gets added. The feelings come. The decisions and the actions and the attributes are effortlessly present in our lives because we simply see ourselves as the other person and see the other person as ourselves. That's what we have to let go of. Who we think we are as separate from somebody else needs to die, needs to be dropped like nets on the beach. If we're ever going to be able to enter in, as Thomas Merton says, to the sanctuary of another's subjectivity, the only way that ever happens is when we let go, push off, allow ourselves to become small so that someone else can enter our space. If we're always filling all of our own space, how does anyone else get any chance to be part of it? All we see is ourselves. Until we can start to take no notice of wickedness, we lose. Can you see now the centrality, the essential nature of Jesus telling us not to judge? Can you see how that works? What did he say at Matthew 7? Do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. The moment that we judge, the moment that we discern, the moment that we take notice of wickedness, what we've done is we put a gulf between us and the person or the thing that we're judging. We're no longer one. We're separate. We're apart. And as long as we're separate and apart, we are not connected to the God that brings us the love that we so desperately need. As long as we keep judging wickedness, we fall short of unity. And if we're short of unity, then we're living in fear. The only way to make that quantum leap we talked about last week, moving from fear to love, is to somehow negotiate this crazy space, this identification. To leave the identification with the thoughts that roll around in our heads and to move it out into the other and ultimately to God's Spirit. It seems like an impossible thing to do, but it's not. How is it not? How is it not? As soon as we can move our thoughts from what to how, we have taken the first step. As soon as we're living a process that takes us moment by moment into the presence of each other and the presence of God, we are experiencing everything we need to begin the process of letting down the things that we hold so dear that are frustrating everything that we are about. From what to how, from fear to love, from action, decision, feeling, and attribute to identification. That's the spiritual journey. Got to get busy. Let's pray. Father, thank you once again. It's hard not to make things complicated, I suppose. Maybe it's just hard for me. But it really is simple. If we can start to break up our soil, Father, to step away from hard-packed beliefs, we have the option to start letting them down. We want to see you. Help us to not be afraid. Help us to be able to just go where we need to go and let go of the things that need to be let go of, to become willing, to become ready, to let go of everything that keeps us from you, whether we know that or not. Allow our desire to guide us. Help us to know that our desire is enough, that that is pleasing, that will take us everywhere we need to go. Stoke the desire of our hearts, Lord, to want more of you, to be restless until we rest in you. That's what we want, Father. Help us to rest in you. And thank you for every help along the way. Thank you for continuing to draw us and love us the way that you do, for never giving up on us, and for loving us like your precious sons and daughters each moment of our lives. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.